Okay, well, I'm enjoying this workshop greatly. I'm a bit of a newcomer to the field of high harmonic generation, so I'm going to tell you about some plans of attack on realistic molecules, in particular looking at the Renin-Kapteyn group's recent experiment on SF6 will be the main focus of my talk, but I also want to talk a little about approximations that have been used extensively in the imaging and tomography of molecular orbitals that we are skeptical about, and want to show you some of the reasons why. The main driver on the SF6 project has been Zach Walters and Stefano Tanzani, and we've had support for this work from the Department of Energy and also partial support from the NSF EUVERC Center that Henry and Margaret are drivers on. Some of you have asked about my daughter. She used to be a small human. She's now a larger human, and she's going to the University of Chicago. We didn't see whales last weekend, but we were out kayaking in the harbor, and we got up close to the buoys and saw some neat seals and dolphins. So that was kind of a fun 2 hours when she visited last weekend.
Can you kayak?
Yeah, I did that all the time in Nebraska. In my misspent youth on the plains of Nebraska. So the two topics I want to cover are, first of all, trying to make as quantitative as possible but still being doable to treat high harmonic generation in complex polyatomic molecules, which to a physicist, SF6 is a complex polyatomic molecule, probably not to a chemist. And the main work, experimental work that we have been trying to understand is this Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences article that I think just came out this week. And then the second point, I'll see how much time I have to devote to this imaging issues. I want to mention there is another related paper, this Marengos group study on CH4 rearrangement, that where they are looking at a little different physics than in this SF6 experiment, where you do high harmonic generation and you have the electron leaving, and then you actually see during the time between the electron leaving and recolliding, you see the rearrangement of the methane. Fluorine atoms, as you know, are much heavier than hydrogen atoms, and so this sort of rearrangement during the electron excursion in SF6, we're going to completely neglect. But this is a nice experiment still. It's seen the same kind of chemical, vibrational motion dynamics, although in a sort of a different sense, a different time scale. In this case, they focus their explanations, I should mention, on this sort of correlation function, the nuclear correlation function between the time when the electron left and returned, and explained a lot in terms of that. We are basically, in everything I'm going to do in SF6, approximating this by unity, assuming that in the femtosecond or so that the electron is away, the nuclei don't have time to move enough for this to be important during that part of the time. The way we're talking about this high harmonic experiment in SF6 is that it's basically a quantum beat experiment. And the quantum beats are occurring between different Raman excited modes. This work I'm going to tell you about, by the way, is unpublished. We haven't finished writing it up yet. And it's not quite even advanced enough to put on the preprint on the wiki. But I'm glad to talk to anyone about it. Hopefully within a few weeks it'll be ready for publication. In any case, as I said, we aren't focusing on this, although we could add that. If, for instance, we were going to treat molecules that contained hydrogen atoms, this would probably be important. Let me remind you a little bit about SF6, the vibrational motion. There are six normal modes plus degeneracies. There are three Raman active modes, the symmetric stretch, which is non-degenerate, and then there is a doubly degenerate V2 mode at 643 wave numbers. The symmetric stretch is at 775. And then the other Raman active mode is this V5, which is a triply degenerate T2G symmetry, if you are familiar with the IRAPs of the octahedral group. Then there are some infrared active modes that are not seen in Raman experiments. Well, actually two, this V3 and V4, and there is a forbidden mode, triply degenerate mode. Now, Margaret Henry could explain this nicely, how the experiment works.
And then we hit the molecule with a bar of light, then it starts to ring, vibrate, and then at the different times of these after that initial pulse, we then excite harmonic generation, sucking the electron from the molecule and slamming it back in, and seeing if we could see the very small shape changes in the molecule by monitoring the X-ray signal. And so this is going to be published this week at PNAS. And it turned out that every single harmonic we looked at exhibits this modulation in the X-ray emission due to the vibrational wave packet. And so you can see either in this 2D plot that shows all of the harmonic orders as a function of time, or in this line out, that you first get a bright burst of X-rays, and that's just because when the pump and probe are overlapped, there's simply more laser signal there to generate the X-rays. But then, after the pump that excited the vibrational wave packet is passed, then the X-ray signal still oscillates. And it turns out that the period of oscillation is on the correct few tens of femtoseconds that is characteristic of the expected vibrations in this molecule. And to see what vibrations are present, we make a Fourier transform of that modulation, and three peaks come out very clearly. And this is in the 47th harmonic, one at around 16 terahertz, 19.5 terahertz, and 23 terahertz. And so the question is, are these known vibrations in the molecule? And we can just look up Hertzberg and look for this.
Okay. Thank you, Margaret. Okay, here is what the modes look like. If you want to see what the nuclei are really doing, the symmetric stretch is obviously every fluorine atom simultaneously moving away. The doubly degenerate and triply degenerate modes are these more asymmetrical kinds of motions. And so this is the main data, this this bright initial pulse that was mentioned, and then this ringing, which is a superposition of the different vibrational modes of the molecule vibrating against each other. And this is the Fourier transform spectrum showing the signatures of the three Raman active modes that you would expect to see potentially after you have this first Raman excitation pulse, then which is weaker, it's like 5×10^13 watts per square centimeter intensity, and then there's the second pulse around, I think, 3×10^14 watts per square centimeter, which is going to do the actual, strong enough to do a significant harmonic generation. And what they're varying is the time delay between those two pulses, and then here's the Fourier transform of it showing the vibrational modes. But there is one big surprise in this, which is that in the usual Raman spectrum, you see basically almost exclusively this symmetric stretch mode. And these two are very, very weak, almost invisible. I think I have a more conventional Raman spectrum here. I think this you took this data too in your group, just at a different wavelength. Is that the...
It's a slightly different experiment. With that, we're probing with... We excite the molecule the same way, but the probe is a narrow band pulse that comes in and develops sine waves and gamma frequencies directly.
It's a blue visible probe.
So it is a different wavelength, and it's done with the different temporal dynamics.
It doesn't involve high harmonics.
Oh, yeah, right. There's no high harmonics here at all.
It meets two laser beams?
For this conventional one?
And your Korn has also done the exact same experiment. And so we, you know, in you know, different countries, whatever, you can only see this dry Raman mode with the visible scattering experiment, but one strong one.
In different countries, not Brazil, but...
that experiment is also so much confusing.
That's very
confusing.
Okay, but anyway, this intrigued me, the fact that if you see so much stronger dominance of this, why isn't it dominant in the high harmonic generation? If you, that Raman excitation sets the molecule ringing, why isn't it still in high harmonic generation when you look at it here, still the dominant one? That was one of the main mysteries we wanted to understand. And so in fact, what were our goals in starting out on this project, in addition to finding out why that first symmetric stretch Raman mode is no longer dominant, we also wanted to just understand qualitatively at least the gross magnitude. Why is it a few percent instead of 50% or a tenth of a percent modulation. Since we were new to the field and a little skeptical about some of the approximations in the simple man model, we have also decided at various points to try to improve upon a lot of the approximations that go into high harmonic generation calculations, like using a plane wave approximation for the returning electron, which is very commonly done. We have tried to use much more realistic molecular physics for the electron molecule recollision in particular. And then lastly, we wanted to formulate this sort of as a big picture as a quantum mechanical interference problem, not just as sort of classically thinking of the nuclei moving. These are really, to us, quantum beats that are being seen. It's a quantum interference effect. And so that means we have to identify what are the coherent and indistinguishable pathways whose amplitudes are combining and quantum mechanically interfering. And so this is the big picture slide. Okay, the rest is kind of details on how we implemented the different steps to different levels of approximation. But here is our cartoon picture of how this experiment works. You have the first Raman pulse, which, you know, basically at the temperatures we're talking about, you can say the molecule, every mode is in its ground vibrational state to a pretty good approximation. And then after the Raman pulse, this is like a beam splitter. It takes each mode that's Raman active and moves part of its population still in the ground state, and some other small fraction gets put in the first vibrational mode for that Raman, that whichever vibrational mode we're talking about. Then there is a time delay between the two laser pulses, the ionizing or harmonic generating pulse, and this is what's being varied, and it's this time scale that is being measured in those oscillating phenomena. And so in the time interval between these, of course, the molecule is just evolving at the vibrational frequency appropriate for that mode. It'll be different for the three different modes, of course. Then there's an ionizing pulse, and this has a number of things that happen at this point after this time delay when the second pulse, 25 femtosecond pulse, hits. First of all, the electron tunnels, as in the usual simple man model. And there is a tunneling amplitude. You can think of it as, in WKB language, as a tunneling sort of an integral, probably over the least action path is the most dominant you would expect. And you might ask, why would I expect it to produce vibrational excitation? And the reason is that as I stretch the molecule, as I move the nuclei in the molecule, I'm changing the molecular potentials. I'm changing both how the potential the electron has to tunnel through to get outside the molecule, and I am also changing the orbital energy as I move the nuclei. And those two effects change this WKB tunneling integral and make it dependent on the nuclear coordinates, the normal modes. Because of that, there will be an amplitude to change through essentially the first term in the Taylor expansion, or the linear term in Q when I do a Taylor expansion of this WKB tunneling amplitude. So there will be a constant term, which is the normal piece, this I naught, for not changing V. But then there is a first order term in the normal modes, which gives the amplitude to change from V equals 0 to V equals 1. And we actually evaluate it basically this way, as this sort of a normal mode derivative of this tunneling amplitude.
So literally, what would be the equation for I0?
It would be the same without the derivative. I mean, I1, yeah, has various factors from the harmonic oscillator type matrix elements. We use the harmonic oscillator model for the normal mode of the neutral SF6.
I feel dumb, but what's the coordinate R in the integral?
The electron coordinate. It's the electron tunneling through the potential, combined potential of the molecule plus the external field.
So I think this is probably the same picture, but you could also think of it as sort of a Frank Conan excitation of the equilibrium configuration of the ion is different, and when you pluck the electron out, you excite vibrational modes according to some Frank Conan overlap. Does that boil down to the same?
No, I think it's actually quite different, because the nuclei don't have time to really move into the positions of the ion. In fact, the ion surface turns out to be dissociative. It's not even bound. So all of the quantum numbers here are neutral molecule quantum numbers. The electron is just gone for such a short time that we just say the nuclear wave functions don't have time to change during that time interval. And if there was more time, or if it was hydrogens, yeah, then it might go to the ion, and there might be this Frank Conan overlap. But the ionic wave functions don't come into our analysis at all.
So the K, which is the scattering electron, well, the electron's tunneling, or whatever you want to call it, depends parametrically on Q.
On Q and on time, I guess I haven't written that. But
Q is the normal mode coordinate.
Yes, for whichever mode we're talking about, yeah.
But you're saying that, so what I don't understand is you made a comment that the nuclei don't have time to move. But something's going on.
Right, but the electron wave function changes, and so there is a reprojection through the dependence of electron amplitudes, just like in the usual frame transformation.
Phil? So it's the usual.
Phil?
Maybe I have the same confusion, but from a I'm even more naive about it. I don't really understand. So E plus ion, but you said B, what's the difference between E plus ion B equals 1 and E plus ion B equals 0 when the Bs are not eigenstates of the vibrational motion of the ion?
Right, so the picture is that the vibrational states of the neutral are our vibrational basis set.
I understand that, but let's say that I'm looking at pathway I sub 1, which comes from, so how is that different from the lower pathway I sub 0? What's the difference between those two pieces of the calculation? Because I have the same initial state, and I'm producing an electron through tunneling in both cases, and of course it's the initial state that determines how that works.
You have different initial states.
Yeah, maybe I can write. Is there a light on the...
Yeah, so to the right, so different is the light switch.
Potential spent by the electron is not the same.
So you start with V equals 0, and now you hit this with an ionization amplitude, which depends on Q in a linear approximation.
Transition operator.
Right. Yeah, this is like the transition operator. It has this structure. Due to the electron physics, the electron physics has the Q dependence. And so when, if you think of this in the what I call the frame transformation sense, there is a projection then into the different V prime states. And the I naught, the constant piece, takes you to V equals zero. And so I should have given myself more room. So I make this state, which is a coherent linear combination of the V equals zero and V equals one due to the normal mode dependence of the electron tunneling amplitude.
Those are neutral Vs.
Yeah, and these are neutral Vs. I don't need to go to eigenstates because there is basically only a femtosecond of time evolution when the electron is away. And so I don't really need, I'm basically saying that e to the minus iht for the ion Hamiltonian is one. I'm making that approximation
anyway,
here.
We're looking at pretty large harmonics, so it's not really very highly ionized. You know, it's sort of ionization levels maybe, I don't know, 10%, below 10%. And so it really...
Well, still, this one molecule is one completely molecule ionized, is singly ionized. I is the electron tunneling amplitude, yeah, which depends on the nuclear coordinate, which is quantum mechanically incompatible with the vibration quantum numbers. And that's the reason for the coherence, is this incompatibility, because Q doesn't commute with HV.
Is this second pulse is also resonant?
Well, it's what do you mean by resonant? It's 25 femtoseconds, 790 nanometer light. It's not resonant with anything. You still seem bothered, Phil.
Yeah, I'll just keep going. I'll catch up with you.
Any other questions? I mean, this is really kind of the fundamental point. So if there are questions, we could.
I mean, I'm just still trying. These are new concepts. So I naught plus Q times I1. I1 is something that you actually get
that derivative
from the detailed calculations.
Right.
How much excitation will happen if you start in the ground state and ionize? How much amplitude you get in the excitation?
It's small. It's maybe only I forget, a percent or something like that, a few percent, I believe, something like that.
So, Chris, in principle, this is kind of a sudden approximation where you have an operator in between which has symmetries where you only can excite the ground state and the first excited state, right?
Yeah, that's basically it.
Okay, so you would put unity...
It's sudden relative to the electron motion. The electron is sort of suddenly going out on the time scale of the nuclei, so the nuclear state is reprojected. Even though the field is adiabatic, the electron motion is sudden compared to the nuclei.
So you're taking into account depletion of the initial state when you do this?
It's so small, it's not such a big effect.
So you just assume it's one, and you have the excitation.
I mean, actually, we solve this. Well, during the Raman pulse, we actually solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And really get the A naught and A one, including their full phase. But yeah, this we calculate I naught and I one also numerically. We because it's their ratio that turns out to be important.
This is just for my own understanding. Now the V prime on the other side in the rigorous treatment will be the eigenstate of the I, the final state to which you are going to get the transition operator.
You could write it in that basis if you wanted, but I'm not wanting to.
Since your transition operator it has a constant in the linear term in Q, if you were to express the ionic state in terms of the eigenstates of the initial Hamiltonian, the only ones that would have non-zero transitions would be the ground state V is equal to zero of the original, just because of the harmonic oscillator selection. And then the V equals one state of the original oscillator. But if you were to expand this further, you could also go to V equals two.
Of course, yeah. if there's a stronger pulse, you might need to consider that.
The ionic state in terms of the basis of the initial molecule.
No, I don't view it as a statement of the ionic state at all. The ionic...
Plus electron.
Yeah, I mean, the ionic vibrational modes are very different. It's a repulsive surface even.
Right.
The eigenstates are not really that relevant. The nuclei only have time. They're like a wave packet, and they just have time to move a little bit. And we're neglecting that tiny motion here. And so the eigenfunctions of the ion, which look like that all the way to infinity, just aren't really relevant here. But this is a key point, and we were confused a lot about this issue. You know, why, when we first started thinking about it, we thought, well, we have to understand all this ionic motion. And then later we realized that it's so little that we don't really have to understand it.
So your scattering electron is being solved for in the ionic core. It sees the ionic core potential, if you want to think about it that way.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we calculate the highest occupied molecular orbital in a Hartree-Fock sort of approximation. We use that orbital to get the effective potential the electron sees.
Some people use not the dipole operator, but the acceleration. Is that important?
Well, no, wait. Well, that's for this final step. I guess I haven't gotten to that yet. We can test the gauge dependence of that later, but I should probably save that discussion until when I talk about that part of the process.
Doesn't that take place in the ionizing pulse transition also between the neutral and the...
This is not a dipole. This is a tunneling.
Oh.
This is the usual simple man model.
If I understand it correctly, you approximate your tunneling as a dipole in the nuclear coordinates until dipole order, right? If you write E0 plus 2 times E1, isn't that an expansion of?
That's not the dipole expansion. That is the tunneling amplitude, a linear function of the nuclear coordinates.
It's an expansion of the tunneling amplitude to linear order in the nuclear coordinates.
Right, but that's not a dipole approximation.
No. It looks like a dipole in the end. Q is a dipole operator, it's a tensor.
Not really. Because for Raman active mode, a Q distortion makes no dipole. Only for an infrared active mode does a Q distortion make a dipole moment.
I mean, Q is like R, so that's a dipole.
If it's times a charge, but if it's not times a net charge, it doesn't make a dipole.
It's V equals 0 and V equals 1. Sorry. That's a dipole.
No.
Can you sketch or write down where you get this expression for I?
Well, it's just the WKB tunneling amplitude.
Yeah, that's it.
That's all. I'll give a little more detail in a minute.
In some sense, it's similar to the SFA, because you have the dipole matrix element of the harmonic, and then the...
Well, the SFA neglects the electron-molecule interaction. We're going to do much better than that.
So this is a tunneling you get because the field is there, and it tunnels through
the... Yeah, exactly.
And this assumes a single electron model?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we just treat one electron.
And that tunneling of that amplitude is parametrically dependent on the nuclear coordinates.
Exactly.
In the usual...
Yeah, just like phase shift would depend in an electron molecule scattering on nuclear coordinate, which leads to vibrational excitation in electron molecule collisions.
So one has to know which electron is ionized.
Yeah, the HOMO.
That's what you assume.
Yeah, because it's exponentially, suppressed. It's a tunneling process, so, it's very hard for a deeper electron to get out. Okay, let's see. Okay, so then you ionize. Then the electron does its moving out in the field, being driven back. And again, we're assuming all of this stuff until the X-ray is emitted is instantaneous in our time frame, less than about 1 femtosecond. And then when the electron collides, there's this wave, I think of it as this wave packet coming back, moving through the nuclear field, the field of the other electrons and the nuclei, And it acquires, as it moves through that field, the nodal structure of the K-shell and everything, just the way an ordinary electron molecule scattering goes. So we use a realistic electron SF6 plus scattering wave function to calculate the dipole matrix element from that continuum state back onto, back onto the initial orbital. Where was I? And that also depends on the nuclear coordinates in the same way. And so it's another beam splitter, the harmonic generation step, because the dipole depends also on the nuclear normal coordinate. And that can lead to a further mixing. And when we started this, we weren't sure which of these two was dominant. We could see these quantum beats if either of these beam splitters was here.
But as far as the selection moves, the other dipole that balances this would be the Raman pulse, right? That's a dipole transition to V equals 1?
It's not a dipole transition. If it was an infrared mode, it would be an electric dipole transition. This is a Raman transition, which is a two-photon process in perturbation theory.
So maybe I just don't know molecular symmetries, but normally you can't have harmonic generations unless...
That's the Raman effect.
The transition has the same selection rules as the up transition. So, for example, in an atom, you have electric dipole goes up, so that's parity odd. If you start with parity even, to go down, you have to change the parity again. And so I'm looking for where this balance takes place here.
Well, here these levels are not opposite parity. They're just more and more quanta in like the symmetric stretch mode. They don't have electric dipole moments at all.
Yeah, the same parity.
Yeah.
It's normal for two-photon processes.
The tunneling step you calculate using a time-dependent formulation. Because you said something that you solved time-dependent Schrodinger equation.
That was for the Raman step. For the Raman step, we solved the time, but not for the tunneling. Here, I believe we just went to the peak electric field strength to calculate this tunneling integral. I believe. I don't remember. Or maybe
so,
we went...
It was done essentially as a time independent.
A time independent, yeah, tunneling calculation.
Sort of cycle averaged, or it's just the peak of...
Yeah, that maybe we use the one that corresponds to the time responsible for like this 39th harmonic. I don't remember that particular detail, how they handled that.
So you mean the Schrodinger equation treatment was to compute A1?
Yes,
so
that's what the time-dependent Schrodinger solution
was.
Yeah, that's right. That involves I didn't say that, but basically that involves the Q dependence of the polarizability. Is what leads to a change in the initial vibrational state by the Raman pulse. This sort of formulation for the Raman effect is in standard books like Bunker's book.
But you could consider that if you just prepare this thing in this state.
Yeah.
And then say, well, okay, it's prepared, and now it evolves after time t.
It's pretty
safe. Boom, it ionizes.
Right, and then the electron recollides, and then there's a dipole matrix on.
Rescatters,
right.
In other words, you could also use a dipole preparation if the vibration is dipolative.
Yeah, I believe you could see the infrared modes if you did the first step with a photon to drive an infrared transition. Although we haven't looked at that in great detail, but I believe ideas like that would be worth exploring.
And the Raman pulse, at which frequency is it? It's a high frequency.
It's also 790 nanometers.
It's out.
The only thing I guess that I'm still, maybe bring this up, and I'm still confused about, I guess.
How ions can move in this femtosecond?
Thank you.
That's the question I'm thinking about.
They don't move, but their quantum state changes.
Yeah.
Because there is something in the problem that's quantum mechanically incompatible with this V quantum number, and it relates to the electron physics.
But if the nuclei have to move, don't they? Between two particles?
No, their quantum state changes. They don't have to move. I mean, it's not classical physics here. It's how their quantum state changes.
I think you can also buy classical physics.
No, no, but I mean, none of it wouldn't. What I'm saying is, if it wasn't for the fact that there was a Q dependence in that expression, right?
Right.
But the Q dependence is the consideration of the nuclei, right?
The Q, I mean, that is what it describes, but this is a quantum process. So whether you want to say the nuclei are moving or not, I'm not wanting to talk that way. It's the quantum state the nuclei are in that I'm focusing on.
I think we've grilled Chris enough.
No, we're not grilled.
We ought to go on and maybe some of it will be clear.
What is the typical time gap?
I think it's maybe a picosecond or so, isn't it? It was on this other graph.
Between 1 part and 2nd.
We aren't saying the nuclei don't move between the pulses. Yeah, during that time they move.
And that's the crucial thing, is the crucial Q dependence.
Right. Yeah, so it's up to 1 picosecond.
And they move in a sense classical. You can this movement also treat as classical. They stretch to some point, right, and then I see everything here classical. I don't need quantum.
Well, I disagree. This is quantum interference.
So when this move to the right point, I understand. No, I see everything classical.
But you know that anyway, if it's an oscillator, it doesn't matter because the quantum mechanical oscillator and the classical oscillator are exactly the same.
So you can describe this by classical physics.
Let's let Chris go on.
Okay, anyway, that's the basic picture. We have the two beam splitters. We did also consider a third beam splitter, which is the fact that this ionizing pulse can also produce additional Raman excitation.
Can I ask you one more thing? And this is in your second beam splitter, if you make a linear approximation, why can't you also reach dV equals 2 then? Because if it's again a structure which is constant and linear in Q, this should also take you to V equals 2.
Right. Our final modulation amplitude will turn out to be linear in things like this I1 and D1, and those terms would be quadratic.
Ah, so there you throw that away.
So, yeah, we've neglected that, but it would be there, and it would be more important if you had more intense pulses. But I was starting to say that we also consider the Raman effect of this pulse because, well, it's actually stronger than this one, which was producing, and it's at the same frequency. So this actually produces Raman excitations also, but we found that those drop out and don't actually affect the final modulation, strength of the modulation, so I haven't included it in this diagram.
Why do they drop out?
It's basically because during the Raman pulse, it's a unitary evolution of the wave function, and to the extent it's a two-level system, that unitary system preserves orthogonality, and those terms dropped out. It surprised me. I didn't see that happening at first, but I'll show you a table that documents that.
Do the Raman and the ionizing pulse have the same duration?
I think so. Aren't they about the same?
The Raman pulse is longer because we don't want to ionize the molecule.
You have to keep the pulse a lot shorter than the
It's not a lot longer.
I thought it was about the same.
It should be the same. Yeah.
Okay.
I know we're never going to let you finish, but this term that you do have, the I1 term, should be proportional to the Raman term. They both depend on d by dq of the dipole.
No, this one depends on d by dq of the tunneling amplitude. whereas this depended on the d by dq of alpha.
Polarizability.
Yeah.
Which is basically a dipole, I think.
You can say that, yeah.
Okay.
All right. And then, you know, in the usual rules of quantum mechanics, you find all the amplitudes that end up in V equals zero, and you combine them and square it. And you find all the ones that end up in V equals one, you combine them and square it. They're in principle distinguishable, and so they're incoherent contribution to the final high harmonic generation rate. I learned that from Tony. Nope, they're in principle distinguishable, so they don't interfere.
No. So you can add the squares rather than square
right.
the
adds. Yeah. Am I going backwards? Okay, I don't understand why. If you want to just do an order of magnitude estimate and neglect the dependence of the recombination dipole on Q, you can carry through that. And we find that this alone, just the ionization dependence on Q, would give amplitude modulation of the 2 to 5% range, which is not too different than the experiment. So when we did this back of the envelope calculation, we were kind of encouraged that we were on the right track to understanding the strength of these modulations. If you really put all these pieces together, I just said, you get this kind of an expression. Actually, I've changed notation. These D's are what I called the capital A's in the previous graph. And these R's are the dipole, or I guess what I had is the dipole strengths D for the recombination. But anyway, you get a non-modulated term, you get an oscillating term, and you can get the fractional modulation, the strength of the oscillations relative to the non-oscillating background as this kind of a ratio, which is what we're actually then trying to calculate and put as much physics as we can to get as close to this. But you can see there's real interference, and these terms are, actually the R's are complex. I think the I's, the way we calculate them, are real. But there can be constructive or destructive interference between these different beam splitters. Okay, now I'm going forward. Okay, so here's how we do it in detail. As I said, we directly solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation using the Q-dependent polarizability for each mode, which can change the quantum states, now written as Ni instead of Vi. Then we calculate the tunneling integral, and we use the molecular orbital in the non-tunneling region then to get the amplitude. This is probably the piece of this that is the weakest approximation, and we probably want to understand this tunneling step better. But we think that the main thing is this tunneling integral, and that has the right qualitative physics. Now, in terms of what we do during the time between the electron tunnels out and recollides, we assume the nuclear state does not change during that one femtosecond time interval. And so we can compute the classical trajectory for the electron going out and coming back, and we want to connect this somehow to the electron molecule scattering wave function, because we really think these plane wave approximations are really weak. And so we are going to need some quantum mechanical representation of this wave packet of the returning electron. So we calculate the classical trajectories, including the Coulomb field and the external electric field, time-dependent, and we get the action integral that appears in the usual Goetz-Wheeler-Van Vleck propagator. There's this screwy determinant amplitude that comes in front. But for a single class, single bundle of trajectories like this, which are so simple, going out, coming in, this is actually all quite simple to calculate. If you start really going to longer time trajectories and orbits, it gets to be a disaster, and you have to worry about all kinds of singularities in this determinant. But we didn't have to do that here.
But this is not a single wave collision. It's kind of periodic. Is it?
We're just considering one.
Which is a good approximation.
Yeah. I think so. Then, basically, we have an approximation to the quantum mechanical propagator, this K, or Green's function, time-dependent Green's function. And you can think of a surface emitting waves in a time-dependent way, which generates a wave function at later times in all positions. And because we start with V equals zero, basically only this term is surviving in this Gutzwiller propagator formula.
Oh, sorry, it's too fast. We spent 20 minutes on one slide and now 20 seconds on the single one. It's not fair.
So the continuum wave function is being calculated in this thin flat approximation?
No, the electron molecule scattering wave function, that's the next slide.
So what does that little C mean? Subscript?
C, I don't see where
size
is.
Size of C?
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, yeah, the continuum wave function just before the recollision is calculated this way. And then we're going to join that on to a realistic electron molecule scattering wave function calculated using Stefano Tanzani's finite element R matrix code. That's the next step.
The last sentence is maybe I missed it. You mean there is no long and short trajectories in the harmonic?
No, we consider one or the other. In these experiments, they seem to be able to experimentally separate the two. So we usually, in our calculations, we either consider just the short trajectories or just the long trajectories.
Okay. No, but because you said. It seems you mean that if you impose V not for zero, then there is only one trajectory.
No, but I mean there is still the one for the short and the one for the long.
Okay. We can ask a question about when you're propagating this, you propagate it starting from some initial time to time t. The initial time you put as zero there.
Right.
What time is that?
The instant it tunnels. The instant it tunnels. Yeah.
Right, but the tunneling is happening. I mean, in the previous part of this treatment where you talked about the tunneling, it seemed like you were allowing tunneling to happen anytime. It was a continuous function of the
electric field
and
potential.
So what do you choose for
that? I'm trying to remember how we just we tried a couple of different schemes here, and I'm not completely sure which way the final calculation is done. There are a couple of different plausible ways to do it. One is to pick just the time that would classically give this 39th harmonic at that energy. And that's one way we consider doing it. And I don't remember if we ended up doing it that way or if we literally did the tunneling at all these different T knots and truly integrated. I think that's the way we did it. But
this is the T knots are the time when
the tunneling time. Yeah.
The amount of time it took the electron to tunnel, not the time which.
No, T knot is the time when it tunneled.
When it comes out of the barrier.
That is the time.
When it's tunneled through. Yeah,
right.
That's what I would have thought.
Right. It's not the duration of time, of tunneling. No, right. Right.
What is this reference? 8?
That's probably
9-2.
It might be Miller or Gutzwiller. I don't remember. Oh no, actually, this is Morrison-Fischbach, volume 1. They have a nice discussion of this sort of thing, how a time-dependent Green's function comes into the solution of the diffusion equation. This is just like a diffusion equation.
So all of this depends implicitly on the number of the harmonic that you want to calculate?
Right. That's, well, when we integrate over time, at least with that method, we don't actually specify that at this point. It will, that which harmonic we calculate will come at a later stage when we actually match to the scattering function at a definite energy. That's where we will be selecting the harmonic to find which continuum wave function at which energy to get these dipole matrix elements.
Sorry, when after the tunneling, does your initial wave function, which was the HOMO, before tunneling, still have the shape of the HOMO somehow after tunneling, or what is the shape of the...
Well, we're assuming that only a tiny bit of that HOMO tunneled out, and yeah, we're not really following what happened to the HOMO after that. We aren't that interested.
So, do you start from a Gaussian?
Yes. Well, what do you mean Gaussian? I mean, we use the Gaussian program to calculate the HOMO. Is that what you meant?
No, sorry. After the tunneling, this initial HOMO will have been distorted. Because, for example, the frontier lobe will tunnel more easily than things which are closer to the nucleus, etc. And that was shown in the movie that I showed, that this is terribly distorted depending on the field strength. So therefore, my question for this propagation, what is your initial wave function? Is it
it's the HOMO.
It's the HOMO.
It's the undistorted HOMO.
So then I have some doubts.
You mean before it
Before it tunnels.
Right,
and then
right.
I have doubts because I think the tunneling process will distort this HOMO terribly depending on the field strength, etc.
Well, if the field is really, really strong and a big fraction of the electron wave comes out, then I agree. But we believe this is an intensity regime where it's a small blip that's tunneling out.
Well, then even more, because then what tunnels out could be just a frontier lobe. Assume that you have a molecular orbital which spreads over the entire molecule. And now you tunnel it, and then you will presumably get just...
No, but if just a tiny bit is tunneling out, I mean... Well, I don't know. We're only describing this. We aren't caring about the rest.
With the same argument, you could discard any description of pi-monic generation in the atom.
Right.
This is not the case. I mean, if you recombine with the ground state orbit, it's a total misunderstanding of what pi-monic generation is. You only get a coherent signal if you recombine with the original state.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've put in more physics at every step than in any calculation I've seen.
Well, okay, so this little guy, he tunnels through. He originally was a HOMO, evolved in time to this barrier, and now he comes out. And at that point, you make this semi-classical approximation.
Right.
Oh, sorry, I still do not understand. There are two pictures in the room here. The one is that you propagate a small fraction, as you indicate in your cartoon, which looks like a Gaussian. And then you propagate the Gaussian in the Coulomb field. The other thing is, you really describe the tunneling, and then it would be the entire HOMO.
Well, what you're talking about is the sum of the blip and that, in my picture. Okay, so then you, in your picture, if you want to call the whole thing the HOMO, you can. But that's just semantics.
So my question is, why do you need to calculate at all the HOMO for this process? I'm not talking about the recollision, but about this tunneling process.
Yes.
Why do you need to calculate the HOMO?
Well, for instance, if there was a node here, you would expect the tunneling to be weaker.
Okay.
It depends on the shape of the molecular orbital.
A small local feature of this delocalized HOMO.
It's not the once he puts the pulse on the thing, he's created a non-stationary state, which is now going to go through this barrier and tunnel. Okay, sure. I mean, at some point there was a HOMO in the problem, right? There was a highest unoccupied molecular orbital that was sitting there in the absence of the field, in the absence of anything. But once this pulse is turned on, now you've got a time-dependent non-stationary state. And he's computed that. Let's assume he's computed that tunneling properly. So that part I understand. And during that tunneling, the nuclei have had time to move because, well, they do. And now you apply the second pulse. Right? What?
May I say, what you're discussing is basic harmonic generation physics, and maybe you can divert that to some other time, today or whatever.
Yeah, all these issues would come up for an atom, for instance.
Except the nucleon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so now we have to connect to a realistic electron molecule scattering wave function, which as far as I know has never been done before, and it's a new piece of physics that we're putting in. We think it's important. We know how to do this calculation with no external electric field, so by God, that's how we've done it. And for one thing, when the electron returns, usually the field is actually quite a bit smaller than it was when it tunneled. You are actually fairly close to a zero field. But even if you're not, the fact is these field strengths are only of the order of 0.05 atomic units, whereas the Coulomb fields are of the order of one atomic unit. So we think that by putting all the molecular field physics into calculating an S matrix and a full scattering wave function for the electron off the molecular ion, even though it's a static exchange, it's kind of at a crude level of approximation compared to the state of the art of electron molecule scattering, it's a lot more than anyone else has done in high harmonic generation. So Stefano Tanzani has a code which you can find. It's going to be published in Computer Physics Communication if you want to do finite element R matrix electron molecule scattering yourself in your vast spare time.
I have a general question. There's a whole bunch of theorists here. Somebody might know the answer. Recombination in high harmonic generation is basically the inverse process of
photoionization.
So this code is equally applicable to both?
Absolutely.
Processes.
Yeah, right.
So I'm finally thinking I'm understanding. I'm sorry. I apologize for all the condescending about So what you're really doing with using these stationary state scattering functions in some way is taking this packet that's emerging and essentially finding out how to analyze it in terms of scattering state. So you're really kind of expanding.
Exactly.
I'm asking questions.
Exactly.
You're expanding this thing that's just tunneled out in terms of the stationary electron.
Well, not when it just tunneled out, just before it recollides. That's when I'm expanding it.
Just before it recollides.
Yeah. The wave packet, think of it as like a Gaussian wave packet. It's about to recollide. It's just outside the molecule. And we project it and re-expand it in terms of non-perturbative electron molecule scattering stationary states.
So you improve Lebensgang model or something like that? So you improve?
Well, better than plane wave.
Well, I would hope so, but anyway.
Chris, can I ask you? I mean, with your semi-classical wave packet, and do you think you can improve the approximation you make by having a semi-classical wave packet, by propagating now exactly for the last few bits? Does that really gain something?
Well, here is what, the semi-classical, if we tried to take that through the recollision, it won't have electron exchange. We would have to include multiple bounces off of the nuclei. It would be very hard to do that. We'd have to include many, many paths.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
And it would be very hard to include the K shell, the building up of the K shell nodal structure, but all that comes out automatically the way we do it. Okay, so anyway, we can do this decomposition into the stationary states calculated without any external field. And then these are just an integral, and this integral can be done by the method of stationary phase because there's a lot of action in that returning wave packet, semi-classical wave packet. So it makes sense to do this by stationary phase. And we can get a Gaussian type integral. It can all be done in basically closed form to get these coefficients of each stationary state. And then we've calculated the dipole matrix elements for all the stationary states back into the HOMO. Okay, again, approximating that as the undistorted HOMO. And then we add them all up, and we get the full dipole matrix element for the full harmonic at that energy.
So, but where is the nuclear motion playing a big role at this stage?
Well, okay. It's because this dipole matrix element depends on nuclear coordinates.
I know, but... Yeah.
And so there is, again, a sudden approximation that can change V. Yeah, Phil?
So if you take as t equals zero before you do the semi-classical trajectory, but that's lower trajectory calculation. If you take it as that the time when the long trajectory, you know, 35th harmonic would be produced, say for example. Okay. And that's your initial state for the free electron part. And now you go through and you project onto this and you do your dipole matrix elements and you find out how much projects on the ground state from each continuous state. You can actually get what the spectrum is. You constrained it in a funny way at the beginning, but at the end you get.
Yeah, we should, and we haven't calculated that yet.
That would be pretty interesting to see.
No, I agree. You know, that's one of the things on the list. No, I agree. We want to see if this gives a good description of the whole harmonic spectrum. We haven't done it yet.
Sorry, why can't you calculate the dipole overlap directly between the homomorphic dipole operator and this string colliding semi-classical wave function?
Well, that's how I answered Jan-Michael Rose's question. It would not have the rescattering properly in there of the electron moving back through the field of the nuclei. This wave, a Gaussian wave packet, when it returns to a strong potential field, it acquires little ripples, and it acquires the K-shell nodal structure in that Gaussian wave packet. And this would not be there unless in this SF6 molecule we included all these multiple scattering trajectories. It would be a huge job. But we have a code that can calculate that full thing non-perturbatively.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you expand your recolliding wave function in terms of these scattering functions. So you can't get more than...
Right, but we re-expand it when the Gaussian wave packet is here, before it has recollided. And then we move... We let the stationary states take you through the recollision.
Yeah, so you have expanded your wave function in terms of these scattering states.
Right, we've re-expanded it where the semi-classical is good.
It is still the original...
No, it's better than if we use semi-classical in the field of the nuclei. It would be much worse.
But it is the same.
No, it's not the same.
Because it propagates it.
So
I match the wave functions where both approximations are good.
So the wave packet is now, it's gone out, it's immersed in barrier, it's gone out, it's done this thing, it's gone away, now it's coming back to the barrier, right?
Well, there's not a barrier there anymore.
It's coming back.
The field is almost zero. Yes.
All right. And now you take that wave packet, this time-dependent deal, and you just re-expand it in terms of the electron molecular ion scattering state.
Exactly.
To get the dynamics inside, the recollision dynamics.
Mm-hmm. That is not, it's not the same as what you're saying.
Are these scattering states extended as a single electron model of the whole molecule, or is it just a simple...
It's one active electron in a static potential.
It's a Hartree-Fock model.
And what is this static potential?
The molecular ion.
It's got the electrostatics, it's got the Hara exchange potential, it's got an approximate density functional for mimicking correlation effects. Okay, then we do some stuff. Okay. Let's see. This is an example of one of the early calculations when we actually put all those pieces together and compared with the experiment for the three observed modes, the green being the experimental observations for these strength of these three peaks, and the red being theory. So it doesn't look real impressive, but it was the right order of magnitude, and it confirmed at least that this symmetric stretch is not the dominant mode the way it is in a conventional Raman experiment. So we took some encouragement, but we were not real happy about this state of agreement.
I mean, it is the dominant.
Well, but not by a factor of 100.
I would make one experimental comment on this, is that we're exciting these molecules impulsively with pulses that are on order of the duration of half the period, and the relative excitation of these modes is very sensitive to the exact shape of that pulse. You could easily believe maybe a little bit longer excitation pulse, you change the relative excitation and get this to match pretty well.
All right, but okay, Margaret actually told us something that we think was more important than that issue, which is that we had thought that they were looking mostly at the long trajectory. And in fact, then Margaret mentioned in an email message to me, I think, that they actually focus on the short trajectory in these experiments. So we repeated the calculation for the short trajectory. And it looks quite a bit better. I agree, we've made lots of approximations. We think fewer than most people have, and the calculations are not completely stable. Even at this point, I noticed that Zach was taking the experimental peak heights from the peak's height instead of by integrating the area. So I believe in this graph is the experimental points are shown for two different runs, which also gives a sense of the error bars. The black is the experiment on two different runs that Nick Wagner gave us. Again, the qualitative pattern seems to be reproduced, and our calculations seem to be stabilizing now to some extent. One of the things that we hoped would emerge from this is a sense of what are the important beam splitter. And so we did some calculations just in the last couple of days, turning off the recombination dipole beam splitter to get an ionization-only result. And that gives these numbers. And then we turned off the ionization beam splitter and only included the recombination for these different modes. And interestingly, they are actually almost the exact same order of magnitude. This surprised us. We thought probably one or the other would be dominant. But they turned out that they're almost quite comparable. But notice in the sum, it's much less than the sum, for instance, for the A1G mode. So this is a clear sign. The only way this could be true when you turn on both beam splitters is if there's a strong destructive interference between these two beam splitters. And that's the reason why that dominant, overwhelmingly dominant Raman mode is not the dominant one for high harmonic generation.
By the beam splitter, you mean the physical?
The V-changing part of the ionization is interfering destructively with the V-changing part of the recombination step. And this is this thing that that this is whether or not we include the Raman effect of the second harmonic generating pulse, and you see it does nothing. It doesn't act as a beam splitter.
But there's three beam splitters, not two. And let me expand on what my confusion is here. If you hadn't added the new physics that you put into this problem, and just said you have an A1G mode excited by the initial pulse one, and the high harmonics is just probing that. It's not changing any states at all. You'd still see, because you created a coherence between V equals 0 and V equals 1 with pulse 1, you still see that as a function of separation between pulse 1 and pulse 2, sometimes you'd be making high harmonics from a collapsed molecule, sometimes from an extended molecule,
nope,
oscillating back and forth, wouldn't it?
No, because the final states, the final V states of the molecule are in principle distinguishable, and they have to be combined incoherently for that reason. It's standard quantum mechanics.
And what's wrong with my admittedly classical intuition that if I change the size of a molecule, I'll change the high harmonic spectrum that I get from the molecule? What's wrong with that?
Well, it does change, but it's through this Q dependence of these amplitudes.
No, but the classical...
If nothing else depends on where the molecule is, there's nothing in the problem quantum mechanically incompatible with V. And so there's nothing to lead to V changes. There's nothing to lead to pathways that can interfere.
You're insisting on sticking to your language of interfering pathways. I'm asking a much simpler question. Okay, I'm asking a ball and spring question. So there's no interfering pathways in my question. The question is that if I have two different molecules and their difference is bond lengths are different. That's what's different. So think of the A1G mode, which is this symmetric expanding mode. In one of the molecules, the bond length is the maximum extension of that molecule. And when it's in the A1G, when it's coherently excited between V equals 0 and V equals 1 for that mode.
Mm-hmm.
And the other case, it's at the minimum.
Right.
I do high harmonic generation or above threshold ionization or any kind of a strong field process that requires electron tunneling out of the molecular potential.
Mm-hmm.
With those two, I would expect a difference between them. So that if I were doing an experiment where I cause the molecule to oscillate between those two, and I look at ATI or high harmonics or any strong field process as a function of the moment when I capture that, which is exactly the experiment that they did, I would see some difference. Okay.
Did you measure the ionization signal? Then to complete what Phil said.
That would only be different if, for instance, the recombination depends on the nuclear size. If it depends on nuclear size, that beam splitter is turned on.
It would be different also if the electron tunneling step.
Well, either of those. Okay.
I agree. But
it just takes one of those to make the quantum beats. But if they're both gone, it won't beat.
But shouldn't I expect that it will depend on it?
I'm sorry?
Shouldn't I expect that?
Well, I've calculated it. It does depend. And I've calculated it using quantum mechanics, which we think is a better theory than classical mechanics. And that quantum mechanics, if you don't agree that quantum mechanics is better than classical mechanics?
I don't agree that high harmonics has anything to do with classical mechanics. It's an interference phenomenon.
What I don't understand about your question is, the two-center interference model, how can you take that out of the picture?
I'm not trying to take that out of the picture. I'm not actually disagreeing with the physics that he's doing. I'm disagreeing with his interpretation of what happens if you go into the calculation and turn off the second of the three beam splitters, or turn off the third of the three.
Right, I can turn off the I or I can turn off the R and I'll still see oscillations. But by God, if I turn them both off, I won't. These oscillating terms are gone. You need at least one to get the effect.
I have a comment to this classical picture. In the Raman forces, you excite maybe 1%, right? So the population of the excited state is about 1%. Now, if you consider the superposition of the vibrational ground state plus 1% in the excited state, the oscillation amplitude will be picometer. It will be so small that there is essentially no change. And so I think the quantum picture is better than the classical one. The classical amplitude is zero.
It is
really strong.
You say you can do this classically. I don't think you can. By God.
I would do quantum mechanically like you this first step. But next I will calculate average values of each coordinates, and they will follow the packet. And then I will calculate tunneling from each average value of Q.
Tunneling is quantum mechanics.
Yeah, that is fixed. But in between there will be classical mechanics. I would first calculate average position of for.
Well, in between we did classical mechanics too.
Classical quantum superposition.
So do it before we go to eat.
Okay.
If you hurry, you can beat us to publication.
It's almost noon, so let's see that Chris comes on the
Conclusion. I guess I won't talk about imaging stuff. There is still, I might just mention, a lot of interesting physics that we have not put in. Like the minute you take out the electron from SF6 and you have SF6 plus left behind, you have a conical intersection. You have a triple degeneracy in the at the symmetry point of SF6. And so the molecule will immediately begin distorting away. And, you know, that could be interesting. If you can look at the harmonic generation on larger timescales, you could start to see the ionic molecule rearranging and feeling this Jahn-Teller physics. But, again, we haven't put that in at our level of approximation. And I guess I'll stop there then. And I can talk to anyone who wants to talk about imaging issues separately.